is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Long War Journal's Bill Raggio and Tom Jossen, senior fellows at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, to explain to us where we are in Afghanistan and in Central Asia following the announcements by the Biden administration that the U.S. would be leaving by September 11th. The date is firm in everybody's memory. However, reporting these last days and weeks points to the fact that the U.S. has accelerated its withdrawal. Notably, what we're now dealing with is the announcement that the general who's been in charge of Afghanistan for several years has left, is stepping down from command of U.S. and NATO forces. So how did we get here? How we got here is explained in a map that Bill and Tom and their colleagues have made available to us for several years. But the map now, in these last days, has been featured on national news. I saw the Meet the Press presentation to a member of the U.S. Senate. I'm told CBS News is also using the map. So what is the map, and what does it tell us about the Taliban, about the Afghan National Army, about Kabul's ability to withstand the Taliban offensive, and also about the mystery of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and the border regions with Pakistan? Bill and Tom, very good evening to you. Bill, I begin with you because your map is now featured on national news, and we need an explanation again about how you constructed this and how to interpret the map in these different colors. Good evening to you, Bill.
Good evening, John, and thank you. Yes, so I started this map, believe it or not, in 2014. And I started this after the U.S. military or NATO started to hand back primary control of security to the Afghan security forces. And, it just was really something I began, like a lot of things I do, something internal that I was just thinking about and saying, this will be interesting to track. And what happened was in the Afghan press, you had an Afghan military official said the Taliban control 8 districts. This was sometime in the summer to fall of 2014. So a district, think of them as counties here in the United States. The districts make up provinces. Think of those as states here. So you had, there's 407 districts. So I started, obtained a copy of a file that had the districts on a map, and I started inputting them and seeing how this went. And slowly over time, I'm gathering. So it starts with 8. 8 districts under Taliban control. What does control mean? Control means that the Taliban is openly administering that district. They have military control of it. They're dispensing justice, collecting taxes, dictating what's happening in the schools, et cetera, et cetera. Slowly over time, over the next year or two, I'm start gathering and this map starts to grow. And at some point, someone from Resolute Support, that was NATO's command in Afghanistan, it's almost a memory now, the Resolute Support is, and they said, hey, Bill, what are you doing? How are you doing this? And the first thought was, well, I can't believe you guys aren't doing this, but I gave them information. And then the next thing you know, within about 6 months to a year, the military starts producing this map or this same information for SIGAR. And SIGAR was Special Investigator General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. And I'm able to compare data. We're pretty close. There's a lot of differences in how they rated districts, how I rate districts. But we were within the 5 to 15% range in how it was being assessed. So what does this mean? What is this map showing? The map is here's another part of the reason. U.S. officials were saying, U.S. military officials, Afghan government officials were saying, what the Taliban does in the rural districts doesn't matter. What matters to us is population control. If we can control the population, we'll win. Oh, and by the way, this information, when we release this map, this from the Department of Defense, Resolute Support, we're going to show that the Afghan government is regaining control of its territory. So at the time that when they released this, things were starting to look not good. The Taliban was controlling maybe 20 or so districts, contesting another 40 to 50. So, and then so this information was released over quarterly, and what it showed was progressively, it was an incremental gains of 1 to 3%, but the Taliban kept controlling or contesting territory a little bit at a time. And what it was showing that was Taliban control of the districts mattered, because they started using this to lay siege to cities. We saw three different cities go under Taliban, partial Taliban control for short periods of time between 2015 and 2018. And yeah, so with this map, what it showed is the gradual deterioration. And then up until April 14th, when President Biden made the announcement, we just produced a new map where we're basically giving a time lapse from April 14th till today. You can watch this in almost in real time. And it's a dramatic change. The Taliban have nearly tripled the amount of districts it controls in Afghanistan. It's happening in the north. It's happening in the west. In two areas where you would have expected the Taliban to have gone lighter, you would have thought they would have gone hard in the south and east, which they have, but not quite so hard as the dramatic gains that have been made in the west and the north.
Bill, a detail here. This map, which you talk about in your conversation with elements of the U.S. national security, I believe the friends of the Taliban, in fact, the Taliban itself and the communication service that the Taliban run, was also watching the map. And you and Tom, over the years in our conversations, clearly have what you'd have to say is a very careful dialogue with the jihadists, because they are very keen on publicity. So they had every reason to watch your map and respond, or at least feature this map. So that's the Taliban or its friends of the Taliban. Did the Afghan government ever respond to your map? Was there ever any comment from, because we've had several different leaders in Kabul over the years since 2014.
Yeah, and real quick on the Taliban, they actually started creating a map after I did it, and did it using the same format and everything. So it is an interesting dialogue, even if it isn't a direct dialogue. Tom and I we should write a book on this one day, Tom. But yeah, the Afghan government, I'm aware, actually I'm acutely aware that they tried to put together their own map that would dispute mine. I'm quite aware that they know of my work and are unhappy with it. I saw a copy of it. My warning, being intermediary, was please don't publish this. I would be forced to, address this, and it would not make you all look good. So it was a classified version, and it never went anywhere, fortunately. You know, this is part of the problem that we have right now, John, is that the Afghan government is in a form of denial. And they're more concerned right now about public perceptions of what it's doing rather than the actual reality on the ground. In some ways, in many ways, I created this map, John, to serve as a warning to show U.S. officials, U.S. military officials, government and Afghans, like, hey, things are not going your way. And if you address this now, you could nip this in a bud instead of what we have gotten over time. Is we've gotten blackballed by the Department of Defense. We've gotten the Afghan government wanting to put out a counter narrative to our map instead of taking the fight to the Afghans. It's quite frustrating. We're, you know, this is a kill the messenger situation for us. This is what happens when you call it straight down the middle, when you're not willing to take one side or the other in the conflict.
I'm speaking with Long War Journal, Bill Raggio, and Tom Jocelyn, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy's senior fellows. And we're talking about a map, a projection on a wall on national news these last days. What does the fact that map has been more troublesome to the U.S. than it has been to the Taliban? What does it mean about where we are right now? When we come back, Tom Jocelyn will comment on where we are right now in Afghanistan after the U.S. general in charge has now officially stepped down as commander of the U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Is is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Bill Raggio and Tom Joslin, senior fellows at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. We are discussing where we are in Afghanistan. Bill very carefully explicated how he constructed from open sources a map of Afghanistan's districts contested or controlled by one or the other side. However, here we are with this map now featured on national news. And what does it tell us about where Afghanistan is right now? Tom, a very good evening to you. One way to interpret this map is that the ink, the red ink, has been spilling all around Kabul. However, the U.S. is now saying it is withdrawn from Afghanistan's. Its forces and NATO forces have also left. What does this mean about what we understand the Afghan National Army and its ability to defend its provinces, and especially Kabul? Good evening to you, Tom.
Good evening, John. Well, I would say that the coming weeks now are the ultimate test for the Afghan security forces and military. That for years, the U.S. military leadership has told us that the primary mission in Afghanistan has been twofold. One has been to train Afghan forces while also carrying out select counterterrorism raids. The first part of that, training Afghan forces, was really the heart of the mission, because the idea was that the Americans were going to train up, the Americans and their NATO allies were going to train up the Afghans to hold the country when we eventually left. Unfortunately, they've not fared well in this first go around. From April 14th on, as Bill has said, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, this jihadi nexus, has made great advances across large swaths of the country. And right now, it's really up to the Afghans to get their act together to start pushing back, to figure out where they're going to draw a line in the sand and prevent the jihadis from taking more territory, where they're going to defend territory, and where they're going to actually take the fight to the jihadis. Because part of what Bill and I have been documenting for so long now is that the posture inside Afghanistan, the military posture, has been somewhat bizarre, in which the Afghan government and its international allies were not really on the offensive, but instead were playing defense against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda when it comes to controlling territory or territory that's being contested. And that was a mistake from a military standpoint, because it meant that basically the jihadis reserved all these assets and were getting ready for this massive offensive, which, by the way, my colleague Bill, who you and I have worked with for years, John, was ahead of everybody, including the Afghans and the Defense Department, and everybody, in terms of predicting what was the offensive that was coming from the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Part of the reason why they don't like his map is because they didn't get it right all these years. They got it wrong when he was getting it right. So, and I could say that, look, I didn't have any input in the map at all. I'm just a commentator who's just looking at my colleague's work, and I could tell you he nailed it. So, and that's not something we've been rooting for. We were hoping that the Afghans would hold them off. Unfortunately, they haven't, and now the time has come for them to do so.
Tom, on February 29th, 2020, following reporting by Bill and you, the Trump administration signed the Doha Agreement, in which the U.S. agreed to leave the country by May 1st, 2021, in exchange for, and there's the puzzle, what was the exchange? And do we regard the Doha Agreement as still in place? And does the Taliban now demonstrate that it wants a conversation with elements of the Kabul government? What do we know about the so-called Doha peace deal?
So the Doha peace deal wasn't a peace deal at all. It was a withdrawal agreement that the U.S. State Department and the Trump administration tried to dress up as something other than a withdrawal deal. And Bill and I objected to that beforehand, during, and after, because we said, if you just want to get out, just get out. You can tell the Taliban we're leaving, don't attack us or you'll force us to bomb you. But what the State Department did instead, under Zalmay Khalilzad, the Special Representative for Afghanistan Reconciliation, and unfortunately under Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, was they decided to basically put words in the Taliban's mouth and pretend that they were going to renounce Al-Qaeda when they weren't. This is a very strange story, where the U.S. initially, under the Obama administration, sought negotiations with the Taliban. And one of the preconditions at the time was that the Taliban renounce Al-Qaeda in order to start having talks. The Taliban wouldn't do that, wasn't going to do that. And so they then turned that precondition into a necessary outcome of the talks with the Taliban. The Obama administration did. Then the Trump administration comes along and says, well, it's not even necessarily going to be an outcome of the talks. We're just going to put the words in your mouth and pretend that you did it. The truth of the matter is there's absolutely zero evidence that the Taliban has broken with Al-Qaeda. The two remain blood brothers to this day. Part of the story of the failure here is the U.S. government has never really understood this relationship. And the two are, Al-Qaeda is deeply involved in the offensive that Bill is so carefully documenting across the country.
Bill, the offensive. Your reporting and our conversations over many weeks, and Beg pardon, my memory gets blurred on this. When we started talking about the Taliban offensive, the offensive appears to have accelerated. And there have been remarks over these last weeks and months that the Taliban has been surprised and wasn't prepared for the rapid withdrawal of Afghan National Army forces. Is that accurate, Bill? Does that show on the map that the retreat is outrunning the Taliban advance?
Yeah, John, it's a great question. And so this offensive, the Taliban started, just to be clear, and really around May 1st. That was the deadline for the U.S. to leave. That's when the Taliban really kicked it up a notch. And I would say that probably by mid to late May, it really got in full gear. And what the Taliban, I believe, are experiencing right now is called catastrophic success. They are out. They did not expect the Afghan security forces to collapse so quickly in many of these areas. So there was an NBC news reporter had actually quoted a Taliban commander saying, "Wow, this has gone a much faster week than we had expected. Our military advances, our commanders are outpacing the commands from their leaders." But I detected this even sooner, and because the Taliban's propaganda arm is quite sophisticated and quite plugged in. And what I noticed was the Taliban was taking over districts, and this would show up in the Afghan media before the Taliban was making claims. And that is the exact opposite of what used to happen prior to May 1st. The Taliban was usually on the forefront of claiming control of the district, and then the Afghan press and government and whoever else would catch up within 24 hours. Now the Taliban official claims are coming sometimes 2 to 3 days after the districts have fallen. So when I put those two together, and then, you know, what you're watching on the battlefield, looking at these videos, there's another thing with map related here. I counted at least 15, it's around 15 to 20 of these districts were fully under government control. I never was able to detect Taliban presence whatsoever in these 20 districts. And all of a sudden, they just changed. They went from government-controlled to Taliban-controlled. There was never a hint of them being contested. And that is a key indicator that the Taliban just overwhelmed the Afghan security forces, and then things went quicker than they expected. And I think that the Taliban commanders on the ground, look, and there's risk for the Taliban in doing that. They could be extending their supply lines. They could be thinning themselves to defend these districts. But I think they're making a smart move. If they want to create panic and cause collapse, the commanders on the ground recognized it was wise to just keep pushing, and it just keeps creating panic and doubt amongst the Afghan people.
I'm speaking with Bill Rajo and Tom Jocelyn. They are senior fellows at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. They and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal. We are focusing on Afghanistan because of the breaking news that the U.S. and NATO commander is now leaving Afghanistan in these hours, and the remaining exit will be taken over by the chief of U.S. Central Command. And when we come back, Tom mentioned Al-Qaeda. What about Al-Qaeda? What about its links to other bad actors in the area? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Bill Rajo and Tom Jocelyn of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. We're discussing the exit of the U.S. and NATO forces from Afghanistan and the advance, the very rapid advance of Taliban forces, even so that it has not been able to keep up with the withdrawal or consolidation, more politely, of the Afghan National Army. Al-Qaeda, however, you will recall 20 years ago, that the reason the U.S. is involved in Afghanistan is because Al-Qaeda was using it as a base for transnational attacks. Tom, I come to you because, again, here at this moment, it is necessary to restate what we know about Al-Qaeda's representation in Afghanistan. Right now, what is your understanding of who or what is in charge of Al-Qaeda's representation to the Taliban. Is the Taliban comfortable with that? There have been contradictory remarks over the years that some members of the Taliban have said what a mistake it was to host al-Qaeda because it permitted the U.S. and other forces to enter in and clean us out as if they were cleaning al-Qaeda out. What is al-Qaeda in Afghanistan now and especially in the border region with Pakistan?
Well, John, you know, let's take the last part first when it comes to the al-Qaeda relationship with the Taliban and whether or not the Taliban is actually remorseful for its longtime sponsorship and safe haven for al-Qaeda. The answer is that officially, no, the Taliban is not. While some Taliban officials are willing to chat it up with journalists and make unofficial comments, the Taliban has never accepted any responsibility for actually harboring and aligning itself closely with al-Qaeda prior to 9/11. And the reason for that is that they remain deeply and closely allied to this day. You know, one of the fundamental contradictions in this war over the past 20 years has been that the U.S. government has been ambivalent about whether or not the Taliban is actually in bed with al-Qaeda. There is, to our minds, there is absolutely zero evidence that the Taliban has broken with al-Qaeda at this point. There is a mountain of evidence showing that the two fight side by side this day because they are blood brothers. In some cases, the linkages are not just ideological, they're not just of kinship on the battlefield, but are actually genetic because they are so intertwined through marriage and other close familial relations that they are one and the same. And you know, what's interesting is that Bill rightfully highlighted the fact that this offensive by the Taliban really kicked off around May 1st. Of this year. That's significant because that was the withdrawal date that was enshrined in the State Department's agreement with the Taliban. And so they had basically decided, the Taliban and al-Qaeda, that the offensive would start on May 1st because the U.S. hands would be tied at that point. The U.S. would be leaving the country under the agreement and would be bound to not respond and defend the Afghan government or do anything to stop this massive offensive. So it's no mistake that they chose May 1st for the start of this. But it wasn't just the Taliban that chose May 1st. It was also al-Qaeda. We have significant evidence from the United Nations reporting, the U.S. Treasury Department, and other sources showing that al-Qaeda has been consulting the Taliban throughout this entire process, has been guiding them in their political negotiations, and has been guiding and helping to formulate military strategy as well. This is the fundamental flaw in this war, was that the U.S. government went into Afghanistan, as you said, John, to disentangle al-Qaeda from the Taliban, and 20 years later, the U.S. decided to pretend that that mission had been accomplished when it never was.
Al-Qaeda is an umbrella organization, the base. However, in your reporting, you've pointed to other organizations. Organizations is too strong a word. Entities making claims that are loosely connected to the Taliban. The list is partial. Movement of the Taliban in Pakistan, Lashkar-e-Taiba, Jaish-e-Mohammed, Harakat al-Mujahideen. You report that they have been in dialogue with the Taliban. Does that tell us anything about the strength of the Taliban, that it makes common cause with all the bad actors in the area? And is al-Qaeda involved in these conversations? I'm trying to imagine what the relationship is here when two or more of these significant warlords meet together.
Well, again, some of these personalities are dual-hatted. They're both Taliban and al-Qaeda, or they belong to a Pakistani jihadist group and al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is deeply embedded within this milieu, so that makes it very difficult for people who study this to get an accurate organizational definition of al-Qaeda. And unfortunately, the American authorities have spent much of this time trying to play disconnect the dots and not come up with an accurate assessment of what al-Qaeda looks like in the region. But I want to take this back to the religious terms here, John, because you have to understand from al-Qaeda's perspective and the Taliban's perspective, the Islamic Emirate as it existed prior to 9/11 was the only religiously legitimate authority on the planet. And al-Qaeda, the loss of that Islamic Emirate was a liability for al-Qaeda. So it's no coincidence that they have spent the last 20 years helping to resurrect it, because from a religious perspective, it is imperative for them to actually bring back this and restore this Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. Again, one of the many problems with American policy, especially in recent years, but throughout, has been this ambivalence about the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan and whether or not the Taliban really wants to resurrect that and whether or not al-Qaeda is really invested in it. And here at this final hour of the story, we think it's the final hour, you can see that that ambivalence was misguided all along. That, of course, as we've said all along, the Taliban and al-Qaeda are fighting and waging jihad to restore the Islamic of Afghanistan. And now we're seeing areas of Afghanistan go dark in 2021.
Bill, what is the Haqqani network and what relationship does it have to the Taliban, to Pakistan, and to al-Qaeda?
Yeah, John, and the Haqqani network is really, it embodies this milieu, as Tom expertly notes. It has its feet in all of the pools. The Haqqani network is a integral part of the Taliban. It's a branch of the Taliban that operates in eastern, and now it's expanded its tendrils into northern and southern Afghanistan. Its founder, Jalaluddin Haqqani, helped Osama bin Laden come back to Afghanistan from the Sudan in the 1990s. The network itself, it's supported by the Pakistani military and intelligence establishment. It's also based in North Waziristan and Kurram districts or tribal agencies in northwestern Pakistan. So it receives direct support from the Pakistani military. Sirajuddin Haqqani, Jalaluddin's son, Jalaluddin passed away a couple of years ago. He is one of two deputy emirs of the Afghan Taliban. He also has been identified by the UN, by the United Nations. One member state said that he's a leader within al-Qaeda. Sirajuddin Haqqani is directly responsible for the Taliban's military operations, its strategy, and implementing its strategy in Afghanistan. The Haqqanis are, the Haqqanis are embodiment of this network or this syndicate, however you want to put it. Its commanders have been identified as leaders of the Taliban, as well as members of al-Qaeda, dual-hatted, as Tom had noted. This has been going on for well over a decade. If you want to look at what this network is, look no further than Sirajuddin Haqqani and his followers.
Tom, Sirajuddin Haqqani, what does it look like when he has a dialogue with al-Qaeda? And does that mean that he's getting information from Zawahiri? One of the revelations you and Bill made years ago following the strike on Osama bin Laden's compound in Pakistan was that bin Laden was a micromanager. Does that continue with the doctor from Egypt? And does Siraj Haqqani need orders from al-Qaeda? How do they exchange information? And then how does Siraj Haqqani influence the Taliban? Do we know all of that command structure?
We don't know all the command structure, John, but I would say this from researching this for so many years now. When Sirajuddin Haqqani discusses matters with al-Qaeda, it's like he's talking to his brothers. It's not something where it's one organization talking to another. It's a conversation within the family. And that's why this has all been such a big lie that the Taliban and al-Qaeda are easily separable, because it's like saying to, you know, a group of brothers that you're going to separate with one another. In some cases, we know that the new generation of jihadis that have been grown up in al-Qaeda in Afghanistan are literally the sons and daughters of the nexus between the Haqqanis and al-Qaeda. They're literally born to parents that are on the one hand Afghan and on the other hand Arab, for example, that have been raised in this milieu. So it's not something where it's like, you know, it's not like it's a foreign entity talking to Sirajuddin Haqqani when he sits down with al-Qaeda. It's just a conversation amongst jihadi brethren. But, you know, you raise an interesting question here about what Ayman al-Zawahiri's command structure looks like. The big assumption prior to the bin Laden raid in May 2011 was that Osama bin Laden did not, in fact, run an international network and that he was just a spiritual figurehead and that Zawahiri was running the network. Well, it turned out that Zawahiri was intimately involved when we examined the files that were captured in Osama bin Laden's compound. Zawahiri, of course, was intimately involved in managing this network, but bin Laden still retained the ultimate authority and was still ultimately in control of it and was answering questions and inquiries and giving orders around the globe at the time of his death. But this cache that was recovered in Abbottabad actually disproved the paradigm that bin Laden was a spiritual figurehead. This is something that the U.S. intelligence community had to revise their assessments for. But very interestingly, they then over time returned to the assessment or the view that Zawahiri now was not really in control of this international network, but instead was just a figurehead and was basically sort of hiding somewhere and not doing anything. I would say this is failing to learn the lessons of the past. We have multiple indications of that Zawahiri has remained in contact with subordinates, that he's still giving orders. We don't know the full extent of that, of course. We can't. They're a clandestine organization. But it would be a mistake for many people to assume that Zawahiri is not issuing orders around the globe.
Bill, some days ago, there was a report that more than 1,000 Afghan National Army soldiers in combat with Taliban fled the battlefield and fled in Tajikistan. We had a note from the Moscow reporting that the Russian Federation was basing 6,000 service personnel in Tajikistan to guard against the Taliban or the disorder from Afghanistan. What do we know about the Central Asian states and the Taliban? I note this because in your reporting, you remind me about the good old days when we reported on the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan or Jamaat Ansarullah or Khatib Imam Bukhari or the Turkestan Islamic Party. Are those all sentimental organizations, or are there still links to the Taliban in all those Central Asian states? Do we know, Bill?
Yeah, so these groups are currently fight under the Taliban's banner. What Al-Qaeda has done is expertly is organized these groups and got them to get on board with the Taliban project. So they're directly tied. These groups have aspirations to fight inside of their home countries in Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan. But right now their focus is on helping the Taliban restore their Islamic emirate. The Taliban is talking a good game with these other countries and saying, no, these groups won't be a threat to you. You don't have anything to worry about. But remember, they said the same thing prior to 9/11 to the United States. You don't have to worry about Osama bin Laden. We have him under control. And then we got 9/11. This is something the Taliban lie about routinely. And by the way, those 1,000 Afghan security forces that fled to Tajikistan, they didn't flee while in the middle of a fight. They left before the Taliban even rolled up. That's how you know that the Afghan security forces, by and large, have been demoralized. There are elements that are fighting, and this is typically around the cities. But yeah, in the hinterlands, they're fearful of the Taliban. But so back to the stands. These countries are very concerned. They don't want to deal with the refugee flow, for one thing. And then they're concerned that these jihadist groups are going to migrate back into their countries. And because many of these countries had problems, particularly Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, had problems with terror attacks in the 2000s and early 2010s that emanated from these terror groups, from the organization of these terror groups, which were using Afghanistan as a base of operation while they were working with the Taliban. So the Taliban, look, they lie about this all of the time. And unfortunately, Western reporters and government officials, they eat it up because the Taliban are telling them exactly what they want to hear.
Bill Raggio, Tom Jostin, Foundation for the Defense of Democracy's Long War Journal. When we come back, how do we understand the war now that the U.S. has pulled out? Who to listen to? What organizations are candid about the disorder? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Bill Raggio and Tom Jostin, Senior Fellows, Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They keep the Long War Journal. The map tells the story in Afghanistan. However, going forward now, the U.S. and NATO commanders left the field. The U.S. is withdrawing NATO forces. The embassy of the United States in Kabul is reinforced. Uncertain fate about the Afghan National Army, certainly about the Afghan government. Who to trust? Tom, in addition to your excellent site, you have spoken over the years to honest brokers, to observers who keep very careful count of the Taliban and pay attention. And I imagine we'll be involved in some fashion with what comes next. What would you recommend for our audience, Tom, to watch in these coming weeks and months and years of Taliban control of Afghanistan?
Well, I think the big thing that's going to happen is I think Al-Qaeda is going to reveal its hand in these matters all along. While there's a lot of intelligence that Al-Qaeda has been guiding these matters and directing and coordinating with the Taliban and the Khanis, I think the fact of the matter is that Al-Qaeda has not really turned on the propaganda spigot to the extent that they could. They have not advertised things that they could, and that they're going to do that. And that's going to be very telling because it's going to demonstrate for people that they were there all along and that there was a lot of people who were invested in lying basically on the Taliban's behalf to pretend that Al-Qaeda wasn't there all along. Look, the truth of this matter is, and this maybe this is somewhat self-serving, but I don't care. I still think it's true. There are a lot of people who have been dishonest about this, John. There have been a lot of people who have really not told the truth and are incapable of telling the truth. And so I don't think that there are going to be any comeuppance for them. I don't think they're going to have any penance for this. But there are select groups out there that have been trying to get the story right. I think that the UN Security Council has a team of experts that has been really examining the relationship between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. We don't even agree with everything they say or think, but they've at least been honest in trying to assess this and come up with intelligence along these lines. I think there are pockets within the U.S. intelligence community that's still keeping an eye on this and understands that there are analysts and different agencies that are doing it. It'll be interesting to see if they have any pull in the years to come. But, you know, there's been such a collective failure here that it's very difficult to come up with a roster of people to trust.
Bill, the security of Kabul is now the question mark. It's a very large city compared to what it was when the U.S. involved itself in 2001. Your understanding of how the U.S. or its allies will provide or will augment the Afghan national forces at this point, do we have an understanding of order of battle if and when the Taliban probe the city itself?
Yeah, John. So Kabul is estimated to have doubled in size, I believe, from 2 to 4 million. Don't quote me on that, even though I just said it. And that is by and large due to the internal displacement issue of because of the fighting. So far, the U.S. has not committed. As a matter of fact, it said it won't support the Afghan government if Kabul comes under siege from the Taliban. And what the Taliban are doing right now is they're taking control of districts that surround the capital in the provinces of Parwan, Wardak, Logar, and Lagman. So they're setting the groundwork to lay siege, to cut off, strangle, and lay siege to Kabul. And this defense right now, it's going to be all on the Afghan security forces. I do think that they'll be able to stop the Taliban, at least in the short term. But as parts of the country go under Taliban control, and the Taliban are already threatening directly, as in military operations inside or on the outskirts of 10 provincial capitals right now, they're doing this simultaneously. If these capitals fall, if more parts of Afghanistan go under Taliban control, the Taliban is going to be able to muster its forces and conduct a large scale offensive against Kabul. And really, what's the point if the rest of the country has gone dark? What's the point of the Afghan government controlling or maintaining control of Kabul? They literally would be Fortress Kabul at that point. At that point, it's end game, and I would expect some type of surrender. But the U.S. is not committing to despite the fact that there's an embassy there, is not committing to help the Afghan government fight the Taliban. All of this over the horizon talk we're hearing, that is specifically to target Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State.
Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. The final minute, Tom. What are you watching for in these next weeks in Kabul or about Al-Qaeda? Are you expecting Al-Qaeda to prosper somewhere else in response to this success in Afghanistan? We have about a minute, Tom.
Well, the first thing is I'm hoping that the Afghan security forces and military can perform better and hold their ground better in the coming weeks and months. There are an awful lot of, I don't want to denigrate them entirely here, as some people do, because, you know, thousands of Afghan soldiers and security members, personnel have died fighting the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, these jihadis, and, you know, they've made the ultimate sacrifice. So I think that's worth remembering. But in the grand scheme of things, I'm hoping that they can hold their ground and start turning back the tide of this fight and prevent the total jihadi takeover. When it comes to Al-Qaeda, the big fear that Bill and I have always said is it's not necessarily about international terrorist plots, their success in Afghanistan, that we're worried about. Yes, they think that we think the international terrorist threat is going to increase. But, you know, what really we think is that this will be a boon for the jihadis.
Right.
You know, just as there was
right.
a boon for the jihadis the first time around, winning in Afghanistan the second time around will be a boon for their cause.
Tom Jossin, Bill Rajo, Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, and The Map. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.